Well, let's see. You were here. I looked for the tape. We didn't have computers. It was 1976, was it?
Or 70, yeah, or 75, even.
Well, we did not have, I have the book at home, but we didn't have computers here, and I have all of the material now on computers, so I can go back to either scripts or I know where the interviews are, but we just didn't do that. We had these great big 16-inch reels that we still use for editing, but now we save things on cassette tape, little cassette tapes. So our record, the record keeping that I had back in those days wasn't very good, but I looked and I couldn't, I looked for scripts and I looked for the old interview I was going to refresh my memory, but couldn't find it.
What was funny about that book, in retrospect, was that the Hunt brothers didn't read it, you know, and 3 or 4 years later they tried to do precisely that and lost a couple of billion bucks.
Well, you've done, you've had a lot of books under the belt, so to speak, since that time. Tell me a little bit about all you've been doing over the past 10 years.
Well, the first novel was called A Billion Dollar Sure Thing, and that was a book about the dollar falling apart, gold going sky high, and if you had early knowledge of all this, you could have made a billion-dollar killing.
Why didn't you tell me?
Why didn't I tell my that's what my wife always says. Dear, why don't you do what you say? Then a book after that was The Silver Bears, which was a story about some guys who tried to corner the silver market with predictable results. And they did this through a Swiss bank in Lugano. It was a book of fun games book, more or less. And they made a movie out of it with Michael Caine and Sybil Shepherd, and the movie wasn't much better than the book. Then I went on to bigger and better things, one says, to the crash of 79. And that was my biggest novel to date. And this dealt with the story that was came out in late 75, early 76, and it dealt with Iran, the Shah of Iran, and the suggestion that Iran was going to cause us an enormous amount of problems in 1979, that the Shah in his megalomania was going to attack Iraq and then sweep down this side of the Persian Gulf and take over all the oil in the Middle East with disastrous consequences for all of us. Well, it didn't quite work out. It half worked out. But instead of doing all that, the Shah finally got kicked out and died in the hospital in Cairo. Now we're stuck with Khomeini, which somehow now in retrospect, I think I'd rather have the Shah. Then I moved on to a book called Last Days of America. Not a great title. but it had to do with the latent anti-Americanism building up in Central Europe. And the suggestion that Germany at some point probably would go neutralistic, especially if we decided to pull out our Pershing missiles and cruise missiles, by the way, which was exactly the suggestion that Mr. Reagan agreed to in Reykjavik, and fortunately for us, they didn't make a deal. Well, the story there was that if we pulled our missiles out, the Germans would probably build their own, not necessarily to attack anybody, but to maintain their neutrality vis-a-vis the Soviet Union. And then finally, a couple of years ago, I did a nonfiction book with the modest title of Paul Urban's Money Book, and it was my thoughts on the next couple of years in economic and financial terms. And it kind of bombed. I think we sold 70 or 80,000 copies, and that was that. Now I'm back to, I guess, Son of Crash. this one's called The Panic of 89, and this time I'm not picking on, I guess, Iran anymore, but my new villains are the Mexicans and the Venezuelans and the Swiss and German bankers. They all kind of get together and gang up on the poor United States just at a time in early 1989 when we are sinking into recession.
Well, I want to ask you some questions about the Panic of 89 in a moment, but let's go back a little bit. You really have carved a niche for yourself in this particular field of coupling economics with fiction, haven't you? There's not very many people who do that.
No, especially on an international scale. My books do as well, really, in Britain and in Germany and in Japan and France as they do in the United States, because there are always international financial schemes involved and international politics. Why nobody else has tried this out, I really don't know. I think maybe I know the answer. That people who really know this stuff are making so much money these days, right, that about the last thing they're going to do is take a year off and, you know, miss $2 million that they would otherwise be making to write a silly novel.
Well, I think it takes a special kind of person to write a book, a novel, anyway. I mean, you don't see too many people on Wall Street writing novels or even reading novels.
Yeah, you said it.
I mean,
yeah, well, yeah, you're right. You're right.
These are people who go home with Forbes, and they read Fortune and magazines like that, and maybe some nonfiction occasionally if it affects them. I just wonder how many business people have the mentality to want to go for fiction. However, you have the kind of the books that would seem to me appeal to them.
Oh yeah, it's almost like a cult following, you know, in financial circles, in Wall, not just Wall Street here in New York, but in San Francisco and Chicago. And I think that this is reflected in the market for my books. And normally novels, about 75 or 80% of novels are bought by women, and most of them are sold within a 60 or 70 mile radius of downtown Manhattan, right? Whereas about 75 to 80% of my novels are bought by men, and it's spread all the way across the country.
Well, let's go back. Tell me how this all began. You were born in Canada, weren't you?
Born in Canada, yeah, of American parents. My father is a Lutheran minister, and that's where he had his parish up there. So I grew up, developed a funny accent for a while, and then came...
Well, you don't say out in a bit.
Well, I used to. I used to. And I played hockey and all that sort of thing. Then I was sent off to prep school in Indiana. And then completed most of my education in the United States at Georgetown University School of Foreign Service. And then I took my PhD in economics in Switzerland after Georgetown.
And you stayed in Switzerland?
And I didn't really. First, I was hired by the then emerging common market to do a study. I won't bore you with the details, but it had to do with economics and finance. And while I was doing that, Stanford Research Institute in Palo Alto, California, latched onto me, I guess, and hired me as an international economist. And I spent about three and a half years working as a hired gun for them, as a consultant to oil companies and electronics firms and so forth.
So you were kind of like Paul Mayer in the Panic of 89.
Yeah, a little bit, yeah.
You went back to Switzerland. What happened there?
Well, I went back to Switzerland, and one of my not-too-bright ideas, I started a bank there.
Can anybody do that?
No, but, I guess anybody could, but most people don't try.
But an outsider, non-Swiss person going into Switzerland, how does one just go in and start a bank?
Well, because I'd studied there, and because I'd gotten a good degree, a summa cum laude in Basel, I mean, I was regarded as more or less, not quite Swiss, but good enough. And I spoke the Swiss dialect, Schweizerdeutsch, and was married to a Swiss wife. I still am. And when I went down to Bern and started, you know, making my rounds, I met no opposition. And so all you needed really was that kind of a reputation and get the right people to staff the bank at a senior level and a couple of $1 million, you know. And I put this together and started a bank. And the little bank became a bigger bank. And our specialty was foreign exchange, you know, trading Swiss francs against yen or dollars against marks. We were very, very successful. And then, for some reason, we started to trade in commodities, cocoa, sugar, gold, silver, etc. And we were very good at foreign exchange, but a little less good at commodities. And my traders sometimes would make bad trades. Instead of reporting it, would keep the losses in the drawer. The old story. And one fine day, these losses surfaced, and they were substantial, enough to endanger the bank. And I went back to my major shareholder in California. We covered the losses, but the Swiss authorities said, look, Erdman, this must have been a cover-up. You're such a smart guy, they say. You must have known about this.
Did you?
No. I knew. I suspected there was something funny going on there, but nothing of these proportions. And
but it was your bank.
Well, it was my bank, but if you have traders, be they in the field of bonds or precious metals or almost any trader, can hide an awful lot from the chief executive of a bank. I mean, we all, when anybody says these things, we all think of Watergate or Irangate or whatever it's called these days. And you sense in any bank or any corporation, you can sense, there's some problems in that department, right? And you kind of let the people be for, let them hopefully work it out. And you hope, against hope, that it'll ever be necessary for you really to step in. And I sensed, you know, there were some problems in that department, but nothing of monumental importance. Well, it ended up, the problems were monumental. And the Swiss then said, despite the fact that all these losses were covered and no depositor lost anything, and the only people that lost money were the majority shareholder of Bank in California and me, they said, into jail you go while we investigate.
And you were in Switzerland at the time.
I was very much in Switzerland at the time. Well, I tell you, I came over to the chief shareholder of the bank was UCB, United California Bank. And which is now First Interstate Bank, which is the bank trying to take over Bank of America, which by chance is the major bank in this newest novel of mine. I went back there and cut a deal with everybody to do this, and then we all went back to Switzerland to smooth the waters.
Had you had any inkling that you might be arrested when you went
there? No, none whatsoever. None whatsoever. And what happened, I mean, it's a naughty world, is that... UCB had full insurance coverage, but they could only collect if somebody was accused of something. And it was a little bit like the ending to the Silver Bears novel. And I got the ticket on this one.
Well, it's not surprising, because you indicate in the Panic of 89, the secretary who divulged some information to the Soviets about what was going on, and they picked her up the next morning and put her in the slammer incognito.
That's right. That's what Americans don't appreciate is the wonderful legal system that we have here, I tell you. I mean, we see these horror movies like something, what was that, in Turkey, right? Something at Midnight, where people who get involved in drugs in Turkey can be locked up and disappear for years, and there's no way of getting them out. One thinks that Switzerland is on a completely different plane, but it isn't. Because they also have the Napoleonic Code. There's no such thing as habeas corpus. You have no right to a lawyer. You have no right to bail. You have no rights whatsoever. And if you are an American caught up in that, it gets pretty scary.
Well, did they take you to jail without actually charging you?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. They could hold you for years without charging you. You're in investigative custody.
Were you actually in a prison?
I was in a jail. In other words, I had literally a single width bath. It was very nice. It was it was a medieval monastery that was used as a, you know, if you went to jail for 3 days for whatever, dropping a gum wrapper in the street, then that's where you were held. But in my case, it just went on and on and on. And they were very nice. I mean, I could, I was head doctor, and if I wanted to order restaurants from outside, I could order from any restaurant in town if I paid for it. My wife always brought up a case of wine every week, and so forth. But jail is jail. I mean, somewhat confining, right?
How long were you in there?
9 months.
Did they eventually charge you?
They eventually charged me. They gave me my passport and said, you know, if you want to go, go. I said, thank you very much, and went. And they ultimately charged me with fraud, saying that, and correctly so, that these losses were not reported, therefore... Your balance sheets of the bank, as you published every 3 months, did not reflect the true condition of the bank. Therefore, you had people depositing money with the bank under the illusion, right, that everything was safe and sound.
Well, were you actually convicted?
Oh, yeah.
It was, right. But the sentence was, in effect, here's your passport, go.
Exactly. Yeah, and don't bother us anymore, which I don't. And I went back to Switzerland... They probably, if I, you know, walked across the street against a red light, it would be, you know, the firing squad.
How did you occupy your time during those 10 months in jail?
Well, it comes as quite a shock to the system, you know. And at first, you're kind of mentally paralyzed, and then you realize that's going to get you nowhere. And jail, it reminded me of a little bit of prep school. I enjoyed prep school, but prep school, you know, you get into a kind of a routine, and. Fortunately or unfortunately, I had a truly classical education. I started learning Latin and Greek, you know, literally at a very tender age, and studied Greek for 8 years and Latin for seven. I was rather proficient in these ancient languages. So what I did was got my wife to get some Latin and ancient Latin and Greek texts and just start fooling around with them, which I think lasted about a month, and that gets a little boring. Then I thought, well, it looks like I'm going to be here for a while. I'll write a book, a semi-scholarly book on the economic condition of the world and where we may be headed. My thought being, this was 1970, that probably as a result of the Vietnam War and the inflation that that caused, the dollar would collapse and gold would soar. And I would, write about all this. But found out that even in a Swiss jail, you have the library facilities to really write that type of book. So then I kind of sat in my hands for a month or so, and I thought, I've always loved novels. I used to read, almost a novel a day as a kid, I think. And why don't I just, for the fun of it, try to tell this story about what may happen in the economic future in story form. And I tried the first chapter, and I must have been 30 or 40 tries on this thing. And it was not just bad, it was lousy. I was about to give up, and I thought, and something happened. One of the most famous safe crackers in Central Europe, and it sounds like I'm making up, but it was true, a French guy, they caught him, doing his little stunt in Switzerland, and landed in my jail. And, lots of books start with safe crackers, right? I sent a couple of bottles of wine, down the corridor to this guy to soften him up, and then the warden of the jail, which is a very nice guy, I explained what I was after. I want to talk to this chap and explain what I was doing to maybe find out a new way to crack a safe, right? And this guy, after a couple of bottles of Pomar, told me exactly that. And this then became the first scene in the first novel I ever wrote. And once I got by that, I thought, gee, this is great, knowing full well it wasn't. And then you go on to chapter two, and enthusiasm starts to build. I never thought it would ever get published, but in the end, it was. And in fact, it was 1973. Not only was published, but ended up as number one on the New York Times bestseller list. So, happy ending.
Yes, it did have a happy ending when you ultimately got it published, because you were long out of Basel. It was Basel, was it?
Basel. In Basel, they call it Basel, yeah.
But you were long.
Long gone.
You were out. You were back in the United States.
Yeah. I had lived for about a year or about 2 years in England in the interim. I never had lived in England before. And we had a lovely house out in the country about an hour outside of London. And that's then where I finished up the first novel, and even made a start on the second novel, which ended up as The Silver Bears. And,
now, who published the
both was novel? Published by Scribner's. And I had a wonderful editor, a man called Burroughs Mitchell, who is now dead. But he was an editor in the...
He was James Jones' editor.
He was James, exactly. Yeah. And he didn't fool around too much, but he gave me some very, very good suggestions. That I think one, he said, look, the book was winding down, this is the first novel, he said, look, we need, right here, we need an extra chapter that kind of grabs you, where you have the sympathy for this, my hero. And he gave a suggestion as what it might deal with, and it ended up as a scene, logically enough, in a Swiss jail. where the guy, when you end up in jail like that, I think your imagination can take over. And my hero in this situation, in the jail where I had been, imagined that there were rats around and had this basic fear of rats. And you can see where... I guess that could lead to, if you were stuck in a jail cell and you heard these darn things running around.
It could lead to a novel called 1984.
It could lead to a novel.
Well, now you've had the best and the worst of both worlds, and, not the worst of the literary world, but certainly the worst in some respects of the financial world in terms of your imprisonment in Switzerland. But if you had it to do all over again, would you try to carve out a niche in the economic world, or do what you're doing now?
Oh, no, I would never have thought to do what I do now. I wouldn't have. But the last thing I think a guy like me would think of is writing novels. First of all, because, you read novels all your life, and you stand somewhat, more than somewhat, in awe of people who do that. So that'd be the last thing I would have attempted, because my field of study was economics, which is pretty dry stuff, and even it becomes rather mathematical at times. So it's pretty far removed from the English department. I was being groomed to succeed the man who ran United California Bank in California. It's our nation's seventh largest bank. And I probably now would be in the Los Angeles Country Club, you know, in the early evening, onto my third martini, right?
Well, you could still do that.
I could still do that, but yeah, but you know what I mean. And the limo would be waiting outside, and
it would be a more prescribed existence.
Oh yeah, yeah. Perhaps very exciting still,
sure,
because of all the troubles that banks have gotten themselves into.
But still, you'd have a more regulated day, appointments to keep, reports to read, and this sort of thing. Whereas writing successful books has given you the chance to be flexible in your lifestyle and where you live.
Oh yeah, I see. I don't ever go. I don't have an office. I don't even have a secretary. I don't have anybody. No research assistants. Zilch. After that accident in Switzerland, I don't trust nobody. And thank God that he created word processors and all that, because now I can do everything, including the client final manuscript by myself up on my ranch in Northern California. It's terrific. But you still can't. You don't want to become a hermit or anything like that. So what I do is I work up there and enjoy the outdoors. And about twice a week or so, I go into San Francisco and have lunch with the guys. And when that gets tiresome, come to New York and, you know, listen to the hot shots here. And so
yeah, that word processor really has precluded the need for a secretary, because
yeah,
you can make all the corrections so simply and then print it out.
Exactly.
And it's so pretty. I've seen these computerized manuscripts in there, and they're so nice.
Yeah.
They can be turned in without crossovers, scratch-outs.
Oh, yeah. And I just upgraded my it's a dedicated word processor to dual-density disks. And I can get two novels on one floppy disk, you know.
Well, so what do you use?
It's the display writer, the IBM display writer.
Mm-hmm.
It was the original dedicated word processor.
And you get two novels on a single disk?
Yep.
Two novels on one disk?
Two novels on one disk. Now, you'd be stupid to do that, because if somebody would drop a cigar asher
or
a magnet on top of it.
You back up the disk.
I back up, but
keep one in the refrigerator.
Sometimes I'm lazy, you know.
Yeah.
But anyway, it's revolutionized life for people who do what I now do.
Theoretically, you should be able to use a modem and just pipe it into the publisher and not even have to mail it.
I've got a modem. They don't got a modem.
Yeah, sure.
I mean, see, I'm in the 20th century. They are still
That's
around
right.
1895. It's unbelievable.
Yeah.
Arthur Haley, who's a friend of mine and also has a ranch in California, he writes his stuff mostly down in the Bahamas on an island there. And he had the bright idea a couple of years ago to send in his last novel through that modem. And he drove, it's Doubleday, my publisher, he drove nuts. He insisted they get exactly a replica of all his machinery down there in the Bahamas. And they finally got all this stuff up. And then he sent it up, and it got all garbled or whatever. So finally, you know, he put the manuscript all typed out, gave it to Federal Express, and that was that.
They just screwed it up. There are ways of figuring out all the various things you have to do to match up the modem. But I don't know enough about it, but I know it can be done. I was talking to Russell Baker last week, and he has moved from New York down to a rural area in Virginia. And he does a column about four times a week for the New York Times. And he used to have to call the Times, and a copy boy would answer, and he would dictate. It would take 20, 30 minutes to dictate the column, and then when he would read it to the next day, it would have misspellings and typographical errors and mispunctuation. He's got his modem now, and so he just dials from Virginia and pipes it into the New York Times here in New York.
1,200 baud, 30
well,
seconds.
I don't know what it is, but it comes out perfectly for him. And he reads it the next day, and it's exactly the way he wrote it.
Yeah. I use a modem, and I use various databases. The last nonfiction book I wrote, there were some sources, footnotes, which I knew they come from the Wall Street Journal or Barron's, one or the other, but for some reason I didn't have them right. There were 26 blanks. I got on the modem and made searches, and this was over about a five-year period of time. About 23 out of 26, I got that way. Otherwise, it would have cost me days and days and days of searching, through these bloody black files. So, and I can do this from a ranch in Northern California. And on top of that, other thing, I've got a big satellite dish because I can't get television very well up there, and not cable. And for me, there's like cable television, Financial News Network, or CNN, which keeps me up to date on financial happenings. Well, I can sit up there, with my satellite, get this stuff from New York or from Santa Monica off of this satellite. And if I want detail, I can then go through my modem to the Dow Jones service here in New York and find out even more detail. I can even get charts on any investment I'm interested in. Will come zipping through the modem, will be stored, and then it gets printed out afterwards. So it's quite something.
You make a reference in the panic of 89 to somebody sitting on the top of the world someplace with a telephone and a good line and a modem.
All you need, you could be at the North Pole, you just need a satellite, a modem, and a stove.
And you can run the world. I noticed, I just heard last night, a new 9600 baud modem is being released at the end of this month.
Yeah.
And I can't remember the manufacturer. Not too many people are going to have it, so it may not catch on immediately.
But imagine it.
9600 baud, but boy, can you take in the material, your charts and things fast.
Because the deterrent to using modems is, of course, the telephone cost. I mean, if you're on the telephone line long distance for too long, this thing starts to build up.
Oh, I was staggered when I joined CompuServe and saw my initial bills.
Yeah.
I had no idea. Now, I have a 1200 baud modem. I had no idea that I was on that line. I thought the 1200 baud modem was to really make things faster, but it didn't for me.
No. But it's wonderful stuff. And we're at the edge of a new thing, the satellites, the KU band, where I was talking with Clay Felker, you know, used to founder of New York Magazine. We had dinner the other night, and he's getting involved in this, where you're going to, like an apartment in New York, you can hang outside your window a flat 30-inch diameter dish and start to get a whole selection of television programs off of these satellites, you know.
From your apartment?
From your apartment. Now, whether we really need that, I don't know.
Well, we've kind of got off the track here talking about the computers and everything, but just very briefly, although the broadcast is more literary than financial, so I didn't want to go into a lot of the financial material that I'm sure that most of the people that you've been talking to have asked you about. But the Panic of 89, you indicate strongly that there's a lot of anger toward the United States and all parts of the world, Europe and Latin America. I think you tick off country after country that holds a grudge against us. Is it really possible for all of these countries to gang up on the U.S. and manipulate the economy in such a way that there could be a panic in 1989?
I don't think they would. My feeling is not in a deliberate fashion that there's going to be any deliberate conspiracy mounting against it. I have more of the feeling that there could be an unfortunate confluence of events or convergence of events that we could, Reagan's administration would be running out and he'd be a total lame duck. At the same time, we would be sinking into recession. At the same time, the Iran-Iraq war could wind down because of sheer attrition. And that a combination of these events could cause a dramatic fall once again in the price of oil. At the same time, Mexico would be broke once again. They'd just about be running out of the $12 billion we recently lent them. If oil went down to $5 a barrel to bail them out next time, we'd have to lend Mexico $20, $30 billion, not just $12, which would hardly be feasible politically if we were sinking into recession at home and unemployment was rising back to 8, 9, 10%. And that this, in turn, this convergence of events could lead to a de facto default by Mexico, vis-a-vis the American banks. And that by that time, we would owe the rest of the world about $1 trillion. And some of them might get spooked and pull out even 10% of that, which would then spook domestic depositors. We're off and running. So in the novel, of course, I have a couple major and minor conspiracies. But in real life, I think that it would be more convergence rather than a deliberate plot.
Well, you certainly taught us a lot, because I'm not economically prone, but you taught us a lot. There's a lot of information about how the world economic structure works. I was also surprised to see that it seems to be in the hands of so few people.
Well, it's true, though. I mean, you take it just in this country, you take the guys that run Citibank, Chase, Chemical, and like First Boston, some of the big investment banks, and then overseas, the Deutsche Bank, the Swiss Bank Corporation. I mean, the guys that run the world would fit in this room, and this is not a really big room. It's financial, everything. We're seeing immense consolidation of financial power, especially during the last 10 or 15 years, I would say. It hasn't ended yet.
Well, it's another good one, Paul Urban. I thank you very much for spending the time talking to me about your background and about economics, and I hope that when the panic of 92 is written, you'll come back and maybe we can chat again.
Okay.
And I see, I noticed you have all your old haunts here in the panic of 89. You cover all, you retrace your footsteps, I think.
Oh, yeah, and I mentioned all my favorite restaurants and wines.
That's right. Georgetown University.
And Georgetown.
Your old alma mater is there.
Yeah, oh, yeah. Use everything you got.
That's right. Paul Urban, it was a pleasure. Thank you.
Pleasure to me. Thank you.